This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, according to the Alzheimer's Association, 6.2 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease. It affects 1 in 9 people aged 65 and older. Most of them are at least 75. Caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia can be difficult as their mental and physical faculties decline and their behavior becomes unpredictable. It can be easy to feel emotionally drained, physically exhausted, and alone. Our next guest says your needs as a caregiver are just as important as the patient's and has written a new book to help provide insight, guidance, and advice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a caregiver of a family member with dementia? What was it like? What were some of your biggest challenges? Were there things that really seemed to help or some advice or resources you got that made a difference for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Andrew Budson is an associate director of the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center, a School of Medicine professor of neurology, and chief of cognitive and behavioral neurology at the VA Boston Healthcare System. He's co-author of the new book, 6 Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. Dr. Budson, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Well, there's a lot of challenges. These could be difficult conversations to have, but what I got from your book, Dr. Budson, was a lot of hope that there are a lot of practical things that real people could do that can make life a lot better. We don't have to assume that the worst case scenario is what it has to be.
Absolutely. No, it's really so true. I think people often think about, Alzheimer's, my loved one has Alzheimer's, it's a medical problem, I need to solve it with medication. But in fact, although medications do play a small role and they can be important, it's all the things that you as a family member, as a caregiver can do that really will make the difference in your life and the life of your loved one.
You give some concrete strategies for dealing with difficult situations. First of all, can you talk about some of the day-to-day challenges you hear about from patients and other people you talk to for your book that with some strategies we can overcome?
Absolutely. So, you know, one common thing that happens is people with Alzheimer's and other dementias, they get upset. And so one reason they might get upset is that they think, because of their memory problems, that they don't live in the house they're actually living in at the present time. They think, you know, that they're in the house that they grew up in or the house they were in 30 years ago. So they might walk to the door and say, you know, I want to go home, you know. And as the caregiver, you're like, you know, hey, you already are home. But sort of reasoning with someone with dementia, you know, trying to sort of talk them out of it is not usually effective. And so we normally recommend for something like that a strategy that we call the 4 R's. Mm-hmm. We want to reassure our loved one that everything's okay. We want to reconsider things from their perspective, you know, that they don't understand that they're living in a different home than they did previously. We want to redirect them to something that is both calming and will distract them from whatever it is that's upsetting them. And then the 4th R is for us as caregivers, which is relax. Take a deep breath and make sure that we're not feeling irritated or angry or upset so we don't reflect those emotions back to our loved ones.
That's the 4 R's. You've also got an ABC system for diagnosing these problems and what triggers them again and again to try to predict and maybe be ready to redirect. Can you talk us through your ABCs?
Absolutely. So the ABC stands for antecedents, behaviors, and consequences. And when we have a behavior that we can't manage simply with something like the 4 R's, we need to really dive deep and, you know, take a look at, well, what were the things that were leading up to the behavior? You know, what were the, you know, precipitants? So imagine that is sort of yelling and screaming. And, you know, some of the antecedents to that might be that it's, you know, 5 p.m. in the evening. And it might be that maybe he missed lunch that day, or maybe it's just that time of day, it's getting late in the evening. So we look at the antecedents, things that are leading up to the behavior. Then the B, the behavior, we want to dive deeply into it. We don't just want to say dad was yelling or screaming. We want to say he was, you know, yelling for 15 minutes. This was the content. You know, he also perhaps stamped his feet. He stamped his feet so powerfully it shook the china in the cabinet. You know, we want to try to quantify things as much as we can. And then the C is the consequences. So what happened? You know, maybe the consequences are that, you know, we know whatever is upsetting dad, if we give him some chocolate ice cream, you know, then he'll calm down. And what we may have inadvertently reinforced is that, oh, anytime dad wants chocolate ice cream, he just has to yell and scream long enough and loud enough, and we'll give him chocolate ice cream. So we use the ABCs when behaviors are hard to sort of fix with a quick fix, and we need to think about them more carefully.
We're talking to Dr. Andrew Budson. He's co-author of the new book, Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience yourself at giving care to a family member with some form of dementia, something that was a particular challenge to you, that is a particular challenge to you maybe right now, or solutions you found, things that helped you out, call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Budson, we heard from Shirley on Facebook. Shirley writes, I have a hard time with the personality change. They used to be sweet and agreeable and are now so very stubborn. They used to care very much about their appearance, and now you can't get them to change out of dirty clothes or get their hair washed. What you think you know about your loved one is no longer the case. That's not that a lot of people are going through this. Shirley isn't alone, Dr. Budson. What kind of thoughts do you have for someone in that situation?
Yeah, it can be really difficult. And, you know, the first thing to say is, you know, remember that, you know, it's the disease that's doing it. It's not that, you know, your loved one, suddenly you realize, oh, they're not the person I thought they were. No, they're the person they were before the disease took hold. So it's just, I think it's just helpful as a mindset to realize that, you know, it's the disease that's causing these problems. And some people do, you know, go from being sweet to being, you know, cantankerous or argumentative. And sometimes people can actually go the other way around. When people become more argumentative, sometimes it's because we're not sort of understanding how they're feeling and what is going on. Maybe their sleep has been disturbed and they're not getting good sleep. Maybe that's why they're upset. You know, but sometimes, you know, we do actually reach out for a medication. And when someone is sort of feeling, you know, frustrated or irritable about their memory problems, or they're feeling confused and they're angry because they don't know where they are and they think they should go home or something like that, a little bit of a medication that's in the Prozac family, such as sertraline, which is a brand name of Zoloft, or escitalopram, brand name of Lexapro, can sometimes help with that as well. And the last thing I'll just mention about not wanting to change their clothes, you know, that can be a problem. And, you know, I'm all about using little tricks to help with things like that, you know. So if they take their clothes off at night, you know, make sure you take those clothes and you put them out of sight, you know, put them in the washing machine, put them in the hamper, something like that. If the problem is they don't want to get out of it at all, you know, maybe you can see if they'd be willing to get into the bathtub, and that would be a way that they could change their clothes. Or you could even do something like, you know, maybe you're trying to give them a little bit of a bath and the clothes get wet and you say, oh my God, you know, I'm sorry, I got your shirt wet. I guess we'll have to take that off and put you on a dry shirt, something like that.
You also reminded me, mentioning possible prescriptions, that it could be easy to assume that any new problem is because of Alzheimer's or whatever other form of dementia somebody might have, but it could also be things like depression or anxiety because having dementia can be very stressful, or it can be a hearing or vision problem. When should we seek medical attention and not just assume this is a straight up consequence of dementia?
Yeah, it's a really good good question. You know, you want to make sure you have a good diagnosis to begin with, and to recognize if someone says, you know, your loved one has dementia, that tells you about sort of the scope of the problem, that it's relatively severe. It tells you that it interferes with day-to-day function. It's not actually a diagnosis in itself, you know, so you have to ask the doctor, well, what's causing the dementia? What's causing it? But you make a good point that sometimes when someone already has dementia, things can get worse. And you want to try and figure out, is it worse just because of the dementia, or is it a side effect of a medication? Or is it that they're depressed, or do they have a medical problem? And I think the bottom line has to be, if you are a caregiver and you are just not sure, or you're feeling uncomfortable, you know, this seemed to correlate with a new medicine, or all of a sudden this change seems rather precipitous, you definitely want to talk to the doctor and see if it's due to a medical problem, medication side effect, or something like that.
We're getting advice on providing care for loved ones with dementia. Dr. Andrew Budson is with us, Associate Director of the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center, co-author of the new book, Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a caregiver for someone with dementia, or are you right now? What are some of the most difficult things, the biggest challenges you found? What kind of help did you find you needed most? What advice do you have for other people who are stepping into that role now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the challenges of caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, and getting some practical advice for people in that caregiver role. Dr. Andrew Budson stays with us from the School of Medicine at the VA and the VA Boston Healthcare System. He co-wrote a new book titled Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families, a School of Medicine at Boston University, I should say. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience you'd like to share, a challenge you have now or have had helping a loved one with dementia, call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard on Facebook from Joan, who writes, the hardest part is role reversal when the patient is a parent and not being able to comfort them and relieve all their fears when their minds can no longer comprehend the world around them. Your pain will be just as hard to bear as theirs. Dr. Budson, thoughts for somebody like Joan in that role, caring for a parent and wanting to be able to comfort them?
Yeah, I think it is, you know, first of all, I want to comment about that role reversal, because it can be so hard for family members. You know, they're used to, you know, relating to their parent, you know, or their spouse as, you know, sort of an independent adult with, you know, ability to sort of, you know, reason through problems with you and help you out and be rational. And now, you know, all of a sudden things are gone. And it's hard when we still have those, you know, the habits, the reflexes, the attitudes of treating our loved one the way we have, you know, for the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. And now we have to treat them in a very different way. We have to be the ones who are comforting them. We may need to treat them as, you know, someone who's not capable of, you know, being the same person that they were before. And psychologically, that can be very hard. And it's actually one of the reasons that we wrote some little sort of story vignettes into the book that we hope will help caregivers to make that transition. And, you know, the things to do to comfort our loved ones, you know, usually when we're with them and right there and are able to, you know, be next to them and, you know, hold their hand or, you know, stroke their forehead or do comforting things, they're usually fine. Usually the difficulty is, well, we then need to go do the bills, or we need to make dinner, or we need to go to work or something like that. and it can be very difficult. And there are some non-pharmacological things that can help with that. Turns out music can really be a wonderful tool to helping make our loved one feel more comfortable, pulling out an old familiar tune, something that they know and like, can usually be very helpful. Other things that can be helpful include real pets, even if they were never an animal person. Many people really enjoy the comfort of an animal in this stage of life. And it turns out that once people have progressed to the moderate and severe stages, sometimes one of these robot pets that you can buy, they're sort of like, they look sort of like cats, and they move a little bit like cats, but they don't run away. They just stay on your lap. Can be comforting to many people, and even a stuffed animal can be comforting. So there's a lot of things that one can do to comfort a loved one.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Andrea is with us in Menominee Falls. Andrea, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention we had a relative who had a sudden increase in the amount of dementia she was showing, and no one could quite understand what was going on. And the sundowner's effect seemed to be worse. And what it ended up taking a very long time to find out was she had a urinary tract infection, which evidently is quite common to cause dementia type issues with especially older people. One of the other relatives who was a nurse said, has she been tested for a urinary tract infection? You know, and so that's something that I think people should, including doctors, should keep in the back of their head, that we do have to look for other physical things.
Andrea, thanks for the call. Dr. Budson.
Oh, absolutely, Andrea. I so agree with you. And I do think that all of us doctors can sometimes be a little quick to just attribute a symptom to, oh, that's just dementia, or, yeah, they're just getting worse in the evening. We call that sundown. You know, that's all it is. But you're right. You know, everyone needs to think, you know, could this be a medical problem? Could this be a urinary tract infection? Could this be a pneumonia? Could this be a stroke? We definitely have to look for those things, particularly because they're quite treatable. So like I think I said once before, you know, if your loved one is not behaving well, if they've had a sudden turn for the worse, do call your doctors and take Andrea's advice and say, hey, what about the urine? Can you look in her urine?
Thanks for that call, Andrea. We're talking to Dr. Andrew Budson. He's co-author of the new book, Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. Back to your calls now. Beth is with us in Grafton. Beth, hello.
Hi. I just have a tip. My mother-in-law had Alzheimer's, and she became very difficult. She was in assisted living before she passed away. But one of my tips is just to keep your sense of humor. And my husband and I didn't laugh at her, but we still chuckle at 3 years after her death of some of the things that she said and the way that she said it. And, you know, you just kind of have to keep your sense of humor about it and realize that it is a disease and not the person. And that helped us get through that. The other thing is not to argue or try to change your mind. There were some family members that would always try to do that, and it just made everything worse. And you know, you're not going to change their mind, and they think what they think, and that's okay. And, you know, just to go along with it, it's not the end of the world for us to be told something that's not true. You know, we can put up with it. So those are my two tips.
Beth, thanks a lot for both of those pieces of advice, Dr. Budson.
Yeah, I totally agree. And a sense of humor is definitely helpful at almost everything in life. And I think your comment about, you know, not arguing and just, you know, trying to sort of change the subject, I think is sort of the way to go. And, you know, something that happens to many patients with dementia, particularly with dementia with Lewy bodies, is they'll sometimes have hallucinations and they'll see people or animals who aren't there, and they may be interacting with the person. They may say, who's that person? They may be frightened of a person, and the person's not really there. And it doesn't help to argue with them and say, oh, this person doesn't exist. I mean, you can say that once, but if it doesn't fix it, don't say it again. The key is to distract them, use those four R's, redirect them to something that's reality-based, and move on. So totally agree with you, Beth. Thank you.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Dr. Budson, can you leave us with some thoughts on caring for the health of the caregiver? I know it's easy to say do self-care, but on a practical level, what are some key things people can do?
Absolutely. So the first thing is, don't try to manage someone with dementia all by yourself. You really want to build your care team. You want to enlist other family members, friends, neighbors. And even if they live in another part of the country, there's so much that can be done over the internet these days to help. Like somebody can do their online banking for them. Somebody, even if they can only come over an hour a month, well, that's an hour more, that you have. And then, we want all our caregivers to continue to do the things that they enjoy, continue to see their friends and make time for themselves, do things that they enjoy, make sure you eat right, exercise, take care of your own doctor's appointments. All of those things are absolutely critical, and you'll be a better caregiver if you take care of yourself.
Dr. Budson, thanks so much for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Andrew Budson, Associate Director of the Boston University Alzheimer's Disease Center. We talked to him about his new book. He's co-author of Six Steps to Managing Alzheimer's Disease and Dementia, A Guide for Families. Coming up, do you hate being sweaty? Our next guest wants you to find the joy in sweat and all that it can do. We'll talk about the long history of sweat and how we've tried to cover it up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, whether we're exercising in the height of summer or we're hitting the gym in the middle of winter, we're probably going to sweat, if we're doing it right. And we may not be wild about all that perspiration, but maybe we should respect the sweat. It's part of what makes us human, and it can reveal things about us like what we've eaten, drugs we may have taken, could even help diagnose disease. Our next guest wants us to shift our perspective and appreciate sweat for the gift that it is. You can let us know what you think. Have you ever been curious about why you sweat as much or as little as you do? What situations do you find yourself sweating in the most? Are you a nervous sweater? A person who just sweats all the time? You can let us know your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Sarah Everts is a science journalist with a master's in chemistry. She teaches journalism at Carleton University. Her work appears in places like Scientific American. Her new book is called The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. We talked to her earlier this year. Here's a listen. What led you, Sarah, down the path of sweat?
Well, I've always been a little bit worried about my own sweating, kind of mortified by it. I'm a big sweater. So, in a workout, I'm already grabbing my towel during the warm-up. So I, have always kind of been worried about it, but I'm also a science journalist. And I know that evolutionary biologists count sweating as one of the really unique and wonderful ways that humans are distinguished from other animals, like being naked or having big brains. And so I thought, I need to dig into the science of sweat to find a little bit more serenity rather than shame in all the sweating that I certainly do.
Yeah, you write that animals have lots and lots of ways to regulate their heat. We're not the only animals who sweat, but we are particularly good and efficient at using sweat as our cooling off mechanism. How unique are we humans?
Well, so the only other animals that really rely on sweat to cool down are cows and horses, but they don't produce as much sweat as we do. And part of the reason humans are so efficient at cooling off with sweat is because we're naked. So the way that sweat cools us down is hot blood from our interior swooshes up to our skin. That's why people who have light skin turn red when they're really hot, because there's a whole bunch of veins right up against their skin. And that hot blood swishes by water from sweat that's evaporating away. And that body heat is pushing that water into the atmosphere and whisking the heat away. And then the cooler blood swishes back into your body. But, you know, as anybody who has tried to dry off, a wet head of hair or fur doesn't evaporate water as efficiently as a smooth surface. And we have a ton of real estate. Our whole skin is naked. And if you just consider a dog, so they cool off by panting, and they're relying on their most naked surface area, which is their tongue, which is a tiny little bit of real estate to cool down their whole bodies. And so that's why humans are so efficient. And, you know, as I kind of alluded to with dogs, if not sweat, then other animals who are desperate to cool down will use other bodily fluids like pee. That's what seals sometimes do, or vomit, or poop. And so, you know, when you think about it, even though sweat can be kind of arguably gross, we have millions of sweat glands just devoted to that. And it's a lot better of a body fluid to evaporate water away than some of the other options we could have faced.
Yay, sweat. Okay, I'm all for it. Now, water is the active ingredient here. That's what gets out and evaporates. But other stuff comes along with it. For one, salt. Why is sweat salty?
So sweat is salty partly because we are, you know, salty oceans on the inside. So you probably, or maybe you don't know this, sweat is actually sourced from the watery parts of blood. It's pretty much blood minus the big stuff like red blood cells and platelets and immune cells. And so pretty much anything that's circulating around in blood comes out in sweat. So including, you know, big things like vitamins and, you know, hormones and, you know, all sorts of other things like salt as well. So it's just kind of circumstantial. It's because, you know, there's salt in our blood and, you know, it's coming along for the ride. But you're right. The only thing you really need to cool off is the water part of blood, or the water part of sweat. Sorry.
We heard from Shelley in Madison, who asks a question that I came to your book wondering, actually. Shelley wants to know if it's true you could actually sweat out excess toxins. So is there's like a therapeutic value where sweating out all the bad stuff?
So interestingly enough, that's actually a myth that has been propagated for millennia, actually. But if you think about it, because sweat is sourced from the watery parts of blood, if you wanted to get rid of the bad stuff, the bad chemicals that are circulating around in your blood system, in your body, you would literally have to sweat out all the water in your blood. That would leave you utterly dehydrated and kind of dead. Instead, kidneys filter your blood from all the bad stuff and dispatch that out of your body in pee. Anything that's kind of circulating around, good stuff like hormones, bad stuff like urea, that's just along for the ride. And so, yeah, the detox sweat myth is indeed just a myth, actually.
But hold on. You spent a lot of time checking out saunas or saunas in your book. Just because they're not sweating out toxins, it sounds like there may still be health benefits, right?
Yeah, there totally are. So, you know, it's interesting. Spas worldwide promise all sorts of things from a sweat, most of which are hogwash, I have to say. Sweating does not cure cancer. But what it actually really is good for is heart health. And that's because when you go into a sauna, your body detects the fact that you're in a very hot place and freaks out and starts pumping blood very quickly to the surface of your skin so that, you know, you can sweat a lot and cool that blood whooshing by. So that effectively gives your heart a workout. And so, you know, when you are in a sauna, as the Finnish like right to say, your heart is getting a workout, and you're also getting the side happy chemicals that you get from a workout, like endorphins. These make you feel a certain catharsis. So you feel good, and your heart is getting a workout. And actually, there's a great Finnish study that showed that men who go four times in a sauna compared to one time in a sauna per week have, you know, lower incidence of heart attacks and, you know, cardiac mortality and all sorts of other heart disease. So yes, going going to the sauna is good for your heart. But a lot of the other claims are a little bit questionable.
Talking to Sarah Everts about her new book, The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. You can call in with your experiences, your thoughts on sweat, everything you ever wanted to know but were afraid to ask. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Steele is with us in Appleton. Hey, Steele.
Hey, everybody. I was fortunate from 1968 to 71. I was an Army brat, 9th through 11th grade. In the summers, we'd get on buses and go downtown and in the subways. And it was a different smell in those days. The women still didn't shave, and they didn't have deodorants. And after a while, I still have that memory of...
I didn't catch where you were, Steele. Were you overseas?
Berlin, Germany.
Berlin, Germany.
An Army brat.
Okay.
From 9th through 11th grade. And so I just remember, you know, at first I was knocked out, and I learned to embrace it.
Steele, thanks a lot for that call. And he gets into, Sarah, something you spent some time on in the book, our negative associations with the smell of sweatiness and whether we as Americans are particularly averse to those smells.
Oh, definitely. So Americans like to put on deodorant and antiperspirant and pretend that we're a citrus flower or some old spice rather than a human being. But, you know, potty odor, you know, I also wear these products too. You know, it can be some serious pong. And what's really interesting, though, is that we have two kinds of sweat glands. You have the ones responsible for cooling you down that dispatch the watery stuff that, you know, floods your skin when you're in a sauna. But another kind of sweat gland appears at puberty in armpits and is responsible for morphing those zones into stinky places from adolescence and onward. And that's a sweat gland called the apocrine gland. And its sweat is actually kind of waxy, more like earwax than anything else. And it actually comes out relatively odorless. And it's actually the bacteria and other microorganisms living in your armpit that eat that particular sweat and metabolize, which is a scientific euphemism for poop out the stinky odors that we associate with BO. So, you know, good news, it's not actually stinky when it comes out. Bad news, it's the bacteria making you stinky.
Thanks a lot for the call, Steele. We'll go to Angela next in Madison. Angela, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I feel like I'm missing out on the joy part because for most of my life, I rarely sweat. It doesn't matter what I'm doing. It doesn't matter how hot it is. I walk miles most days, and I rarely sweat. So I've always wondered, what am I missing out on, and why? So that's my question.
Interesting. Why do some people, like Angela, sweat less than others, Sarah?
So it's a mix of nature and nurture. So certainly genetics plays a part. Some of us have more sweat glands on our body. Most people have between 2 and 5 million. I got mine counted. I have 3 million. Then there's also the rate of sweat, like how fast it's flowing out of those glands. And that can be, you know, really slow to really fast. And then there's, you know, some people have genetic differences where their sweat glands don't actually develop in utero. And that's really an extreme kind of exception. People who have that kind of don't have sweat glands can't even go for a walk
Wow.
in the sun without like near death experience. But you know, there's also this nurture side, which is you know, when you're born with all of your sweat glands, but they're not all fully functional. They don't become functional until the toddler years. And so in those early years of life, your body is taking note of the environment in which you are in and where you've grown up and kind of figuring out, you know, is this a place I need to be sweaty or not? And so where you spent your formative sweat years, your first couple of years of life is going to also make an influence. But, you know, some people sweat a lot, others don't. And really it is a mix of nature and nurture. And, you know, athletes, for example, try to do training to increase their sweat rates when they go to, say, the Olympics in Japan, where it was extremely hot and muggy. And so if you train in a sauna, you can actually get your sweat rate to go up. The good news or bad news, actually probably bad news in this weather, you can't train your sweat rate to go down, which is probably good because we'd all die that way.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sarah Everett, science journalist, author of the book, The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about sweat, about perspiration, and observation from your own life or the sweat of others? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation. Take more of your calls coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Sarah Everts, science journalist and author of the new book, The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. Back to your calls now with Kay on the line in Madison. Kay, hi. Are you there, Kay? We don't have Kay. That's okay. We got lots of callers. Sorry, Kay. We'll go to Tom then in Milwaukee. Tom, hello.
Hi. I'm curious. I have a suspicion that we are perspiring 24 hours a day. I wonder if that's true, even if we're cold.
Yeah, actually we are. So our body is constantly making micro adjustments to our internal temperature. And so we only actually typically notice sweat when we go to a really hot place or we start getting active. But yeah, our body is constantly releasing tiny bits of sweat to just make a tweak here and there to our body temperature.
Tom, thanks for the question. We'll go next to Nancy in Ridgeland. Nancy, hi.
Hi. See, I've noticed that when I can go out and work on my farm and work up a pretty good sweat all day long, and I don't have a lot of body odor. I don't wear deodorant. Don't need gym. Don't have anybody around here. But anyway, but then if I'm going to go and give a talk somewhere and I'm nervous or I might be a little nervous about it, I tend to feel like I perspire and that particular sweat has a different odor to it. Ooh. And I'm wondering if that's true or if that's just my imagination.
Oh, it's very true, isn't it, Sarah?
That is so true. I am so glad you asked that question. This is one of the most interesting areas of research on sweat, in my opinion. So, you know, law enforcement actually had long noticed that when people come into an interrogation, they smell of themselves. But when they leave, everybody kind of smells the same of this like potent pong of fear or anxiety. And, you know, researchers, when they wanted to follow up on this, did this fun t-shirt test where they gave people t-shirts to wear and put them in front of a TV and either showed them a nature documentary or a really scary movie so that, you know, they sweat either out of anxiety or just, you know, normally. And then they took those t-shirts and they gave them to an independent panel to sniff. And these sniffers who didn't know those individuals, couldn't see them, could tell who was anxious and who was not. And one of the most interested parties in funding this research is actually the U.S. military, because you can imagine that in a combat situation, people in, say, closed quarters, like a tank, if one person gets really anxious and scared, they produce this odor and it could, you know, spread fear, spread anxiety to other people in that closed quarters and perhaps compromise the mission. And so they have hired chemists to try and pluck out of the air that molecule and figure out how to sequester it like you would a poison gas or maybe even CO2. Here's the thing. There are hundreds of molecules that smell coming out of our armpits and chemists haven't yet figured out which is that one that's the top note of anxiety, but they're working on it. And maybe at some point we'll find a way to capture it and, you know, get rid of it too, because it is really a potent odor.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sarah Everts about her new book, The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. Back to your calls now. Owen is with us in Wyawega. Owen, hello.
Hi, Rob. Can you hear me all right?
Loud and clear. What's your question, Owen?
All right. Well, so when I went to work in the oil field and on the ironworking crews out in the South and the West, California, Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, I grew up in the East Coast, you know, and we always wore short sleeves. Well, got out there, everybody who was older, not the younger guys, but the older guys on the cruise, always wore long sleeves. And I never understood why. And then they told me to try it because it holds the sweat inside of your clothing and keeps you cooler. And you don't lose all that perspiration and you don't dehydrate as quickly. And it actually works really good. And a lot of the black guys take it to an extreme. They wear like a waffle, real light waffle long underwear underneath their long sleeve shirts too.
Oh, wow. Owen, thanks a lot for the call. You write about this, Sarah. Owen has rediscovered an ancient desert tradition here.
Yeah. So you can imagine that when you're in a really dry area, what is happening is your water is evaporating up off your skin, and then it's really whisking away into the atmosphere because it's so dry. Whereas in a humid place, it's actually harder for you to cool down from sweating because there's already a lot of water molecules in the space around you, and it's kind of crowded. And so in a humid place, it's actually harder to cool down from sweating. The problem is, though, is when you're in that dry heat, that water is evaporating so quickly away that you are dehydrating very quickly. And so by wearing kind of loose clothing, you keep kind of like a little bit of vapor pressure around your skin, and it doesn't whisk away so quickly. Also, you are protecting your skin from the sun's direct rays. So, you know, when you're working in a dry place, you know, you're obviously creating heat from inside your body. But if it's really harsh sun, then you're being heated by the sun as well. And so, you know, in a dry place, that's why you want to wear loose clothing to protect you from getting more heated by the sun, and to, you know, keep your hydration closer to your skin so you don't go through your water as quickly as you would otherwise.
Owen, thanks for sharing that experience. We'll go now to Kurt with us in Fort Atkinson. Kurt, hello.
Hi. Only my right armpit smells. Is that unusual?
Oh, I love this question. Okay, so first of all, you got to know that you're not alone. I actually got my armpit sniffed by a professional nose. This is a woman who gets hired by deodorant companies to test their products, right? To see whether they work for 24 hours or not. And, you know, she literally sniffs people's armpits after they've put these products on. Anyway, if you donate your armpits to science, like if you are one of these subjects who actually is, you know, putting deodorant in one armpit and nothing in the other to do the compare and contrast, to be that kind of subject, you actually have to be a person whose armpits produce equal amounts of odor on each side. And guess what? A lot of people aren't allowed to get hired to be, you know, armpit testees because of that. So you're not alone. I've heard a lot of what I now call sweat confidentials. You know, when you tell people you're writing a book about sweat, you hear all sorts of really interesting stories about people themselves or their friends. And yeah, some people sweat heavily on just one leg. You know, you hear all sorts of stories of people sweating excessively in one spot, but not another, and, you know, producing odor in one spot and not another. So, yeah, solidarity to you. You're not the only one.
You're not alone, Kurt. In our last few moments, Sarah, you mentioned you sweat a lot. You came into it not wild about that. Have you embraced the sweat now, having gone through this experience?
You know, I've certainly come to serenity as I kind of had as a goal. You know, I think with sweat, unlike many other bodily functions that might embarrass us, like a burp or a fart, you can kind of take yourself out of the room and deal with that and, you know, come back to a social situation. With sweating, it is out of your control, and humans do not like that, especially in this era of curated personalities and curated images. But, you know, I came to the conclusion, you know, sweating is like my body trying to cool down, trying to keep me alive. And quite frankly, I appreciate it. And I think we all should, especially as temperatures around the world rise. You know, as we face a coming climate apocalypse, we're going to need to be able to cool down. And sweating is a superpower that does exactly that. So, yeah, I hope, you know, I hope I'm not the only one who got a perspiration pep talk out of doing this research.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Really my pleasure.
That's Sarah Everett, science journalist and author of The Joy of Sweat, The Science of Perspiration. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, is your mind playing tricks on you lately? Actually, it always does, and that can be very helpful. We'll talk to the author of the book Useful Delusions, The Power and Paradox of the Self-Deceiving Brain. Plus, humankind has faced a lot of devastating diseases throughout history, and there may be some lessons we can learn today. We'll talk to the author of the book The Plague Cycle. That and more, coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Live long and prosper. That's the famous Vulcan saying most often said by the late Leonard Nimoy as Mr. Spock on Star Trek. One piece of Spock's legacy will live long and prosper, his ears. The National Air and Space Museum announced one of the newest items in its collection this month, a set of the distinctive pointy prosthetic ears that Nimoy wore on the original TV series. He had saved the ears as a souvenir for the show and even built a display box for them. His children donated the ears to the museum, where they'll be unveiled in an exhibit next year dedicated to ideas about life on other planets. Ultimately, it'll be part of a Star Trek collection that includes a studio model of the Enterprise. If you want to dress up as Spock for Halloween next year or anytime, you're part of a long tradition. The museum notes that people started dressing as Spock as early as 1967, including part of the NASA team in the control room for the Mariner 5 Venus mission. Space and ear news you can use. This is Central Time.